اگر قرار بود
If our action was to be large scale, then nothing would be left of the Zionist regime. Their false grandeur collapsed in operation. Any attack on our soil will be dealt with fiercely and severely.
Hi, this is Hold Your Fire, a podcast by the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. That was Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi threatening this week to retaliate if Israel attacked Iran on its own soil. Over the past weeks, a long standoff between Iran and Israel, previously fought in the shadows and often by proxy, has emerged into the open. On the 1st of April, Israel struck a building in the Iranian embassy compound in the Syrian capital Damascus, killing senior Iranian military officers. Then, on the 13th of April, Iran launched a barrage of hundreds of ballistic cruise missiles and drones aimed at Israeli military sites. Nearly all of them were shot down by Israel, by the US, Western allies and some Arab countries. It was the first time Iran had attacked Israel directly from its own territory. On Friday the 19th of April, Israel appears to have hit targets in Iran.
Explosions were heard near a major airbase in Isfahan. Citing defence officials, US media reported that Israel had launched a missile attack.
Thus far, Iranian officials have played down those attacks and suggested that they're not going to respond. So we're going to look today at whether this exchange marks a new normal for the Middle East and how close Iran and Israel are to a confrontation that would almost certainly suck in the US. We'll do the episode in two parts. First, we'll talk about this recent escalation, and I should make clear that the first conversation took place on Wednesday the 17th of April, so before Israel's latest strikes on Iran, though you'll see that it's all still relevant analysis. Towards the end, we'll do a short update on Gaza and what's happening there. First, then, I'm happy to welcome back to the show Myra of Sonshine, Crisis Group's Israel expert, Ali Vyas, our Iran director, and Michael Hanna, our US director. Myra, Ali, Michael, welcome back on.
Thanks, Richard.
Good to be with you.
Great to be back on. Thank you, Richard.
So, Myra, let's start. We're recording this on Wednesday again, I should say, and things may, of course, change, but Israel does seem likely to respond. You know, it's just more a question of when and how and to what end.
As far as Israel's concerned, it's clear that they have to respond. The scope of the attack was quite large, even though the defense systems worked very, very well. There's no way that Israel, I think, would not respond to such an attack. The amount of missiles that were launched, the potential damage it could have done. Part of the question is, what is the goal? Is the goal to restore deterrence, or is the goal something more than that? And I think that's part of the dilemma here, because you have what is in effect new rules of the game, uncharted territory, on top of an already going six-month war in Gaza and a front in the north with Hezbollah in Lebanon. And so I think part of the debate happening is our goal to focus back on Gaza and also to get our residents in the north back to their homes, which some people, for example, Yair Lapid, who's in the opposition, has said we should set a date for September when the school year starts, that they should be back in the north and do everything possible to make that happen. So it depends on how Israel is going to prioritize its war objectives. And to me, it's pretty clear that if Israel is going to risk escalation with Iran, then its war objectives with Hamas and getting the hostages back are going to take a back seat. Obviously, other dilemmas include all the various kinetic risks involved and how to do it in a way that will not risk regional war and that will not alienate the US and all the other allies that have come to Israel's support very strongly and very quickly, just days after everyone was talking about isolating Israel.
And in terms of Israel's options, so some of the lesser options, people talk about a sort of cyber attack, a continuation of the sort of covert strikes Israel's been conducting for a while against Iran, could hit Iranian assets outside Iran itself, but presumably the riskiest in terms of an escalation would be a major attack on Iran itself.
I think the most provocative would be specific nuclear or military targets inside Iran. The difficulty in kind of predicting, there's just such a huge group of options, and Israel has already engaged, whether more covertly or less, in so many different ways. It has assassinated, presumably, Iranians in Iran, and that makes it even harder, because then if it does something that it's done in the past, that might not be considered strong enough. My sense is that it would be difficult for Israel to feel like it responded properly if it didn't attack in Iranian territory, because Iran attacked directly for the first time on Israeli territory.
So we'll come back in a bit to ways that Iran might respond to an Israeli attack, but could we first back up and talk about what Iran hoped to achieve with this barrage of ballistic cruise missiles and drones on the 13th of April. Ali, we talked about this a bit before Iran's attacks. On the one hand, clearly Iran felt it had to respond to a direct Israeli strike on its consulate in Damascus, certainly not the first Israeli strike on Iranian military offices in Syria, but a much more overt attack. On the other hand, what relations between Israel and Western powers, as Myra have said, were strained, Israel facing a lot of anger in Western capitals and the region for the destruction in Gaza, plus how to calibrate a response that looked like it was serious, presumably, but wouldn't provoke a wider war that Iran has repeatedly signaled that it doesn't want, particularly not one that pulls in the US.
I think that's an accurate description of the dilemma that they were facing, Richard. Three factors here are important to understand how Iran came to this decision. Number one is the fact that there was tremendous amount of bottom-up pressure on the regime from its own core constituents. And this is a regime that is now facing serious legitimacy crisis at home. So it does really care about the 10 to 15% of the Iranian population that constitute its core base. The second consideration is that I think Iran also needed to save face in front of its allies in the axis of resistance, these non-state actors that are part of Iran's network of influence in the region. Reality is that some of these groups were much more brazen in pushing back against Israel than Iran itself. And I think it was a blow to Iran's credibility if it were to sit on its hands and do nothing after such a brazen Israeli attack on its consulate in Damascus. And finally, I think it's really important to understand that in the past few years, the center of Iranian politics has shifted to the right. The more pragmatic forces have been sidelined. And so we are now left with a right wing, almost messianic, very unpopular leadership. Also, people who don't understand the outside world as well as their predecessors. And so when you talk about some of these considerations, like the isolation that Israel was suffering or the damage that Netanyahu's policies were inflicting on U.S.-Israel relations, those are not things that this crowd in Tehran really cares about. So all of these things came together. I think the way that the Iranians tried to circle the square that you were talking about in terms of how to respond in a way to restore a degree of deterrence without triggering a direct confrontation, especially with the U.S., was to do a degree of coordination with the U.S. directly, indirectly, to telegraph this attack well in advance. Of course, there were a tremendous amount of risk involved when you launch an attack of this scale and scope, but it's also in line with what the Iranians had done in the past. The attack on Ain al-Assad in 2020 for retaliating Soleimani's killing was also a barrage of ballistic missiles against U.S. forces, the biggest since the Second World War, resulted in no fatalities. A spectacular attack on Saudi oil infrastructure in 2019 that took out half of Saudi oil exports overnight, but resulted in no fatalities. And so this was designed almost in the same way. The point was not necessarily the damage or the death toll. The point was to send a political message.
Ali, could I ask, I mean, in some ways you could ask the same question of the response to the killing of Qasem Soleimani that you talked about, the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards commander, that the Trump administration killed in early 2020. I mean, Iran's response, as you say, then was to fire missiles into this US base. That didn't kill US service people, but it left 100 or so quite badly injured. And it could easily have been much worse, which would have made it much harder for the Trump administration back then not to have responded. And much the same with this attack last weekend. Leaders in Tehran presumably assumed that a lot would get shot down, but clearly they were prepared to accept the risk, and quite a high risk, that more Israelis were killed, and that they weren't is testament, obviously, to the Israeli, the US and others' efforts to stop that happening. But part of it, presumably, was also just good fortune. And that's precisely the problem. Now, it's hard to calibrate these attacks. Plus, of course, so few, I mean, almost none of the missiles and drones got through. So does Tehran even see the attack as a success in, you know, in their eyes, deterring Israel?
Well, they crossed the psychological barrier by targeting Israel for the first time since the 1979 revolution. And they also demonstrated that they have a much higher tolerance for risk than was the case in the past. Again, as I said, this current clique in Tehran, their view is go big or go home. That's kind of the approach, which adds to the dangers that we're currently facing at this moment in the region. But again, you know, I think if you look at some of the rhetoric inside Iran and also inside the Revolutionary Guard's circles, I think they calculated that the U.S. absolutely doesn't want a major escalation in the region. Israel doesn't have the stomach for a multi-front war. And so the risk of retaliation from Israel would be limited because Israel is not going to do anything that would launch an all-out regional conflagration without U.S. permission. That was the Iranian calculation, which might turn out to be completely misguided, but that's how they saw the world. And the head of Revolutionary Guards came out after the attack saying that from this point on, if Israel targets any Iranian assets, citizens, interests, anywhere in the world, in Iran or abroad, it will be cause for Iran striking Israel again, not through its proxies, but directly from its own territory. And next time, it will be even with more deadly capabilities like hypersonic missiles that Iran has been developing. Drones that Iran fired as the opening salvo, it took them 6 hours to get to Israeli airspace. Most of them were, in fact, shot down before getting to Israeli airspace. A hypersonic missile would only take about 400 seconds. And of course, in this first round, Iran did not deploy the tip of the spear of its regional capabilities, which is Hezbollah. Hezbollah has around 150,000 rockets and missiles, some of them precision-guided. And so the Iranians are basically threatening that this is the beginning of a new paradigm in the hope that they get to a new equation with Israel.
And Ali, as you say, Iranian officials saying that any Israeli action will lead them to respond in some form. But what type of Israeli strike could lead to a sort of major Iranian offensive, major Iranian response, potentially involving Hezbollah?
So, look, the Iranians have, as I said, established a new set of red lines in an attempt to try to define the new rules of the game. I think a lot of it is a bluff in the sense that if there is a cyber attack against Iran or a covert operation or an attack on an Iranian arms depot in Syria, that would not be the cause for a massive Iranian strike on Israel from their own territory. But there are certain red lines that I think are real, including an attack on Iran's own soil, given the degree of sensitivity that the Iranians have about their own territory, given the fact that from a conventional military perspective, they're actually not well placed to defend their homeland. They don't have the same kind of technology, air defense technology that Israel has. There would be no one who would come to their rescue like Israel's allies did. And so they're very sensitive about that. And the second would be any further Israeli attempts at decapitating the Iranian military. I think those two are real red lines. And if Iran doesn't deliver on the threat, the risk that they took on April 13th basically would be for nothing. And that would be unacceptable to them. Hezbollah is really an asset of last resort. Iran is not going to sacrifice Hezbollah until and unless there is an existential threat against Iran. Or against Hezbollah. But that would be a Hezbollah decision. That's not necessarily an Iranian decision. So if there is an incursion into Lebanon by Israel, then of course Hezbollah would take off the gloves and engage in an all-out battle. But also, as a senior Hezbollah official told us a few years ago, from their perspective, Iran is the mothership. If they go after Iran, they would eventually go after Hezbollah. So Hezbollah would rather preempt and engage from the early stages of a battle that threatens Iran in a serious way.
So can we come back then, Mairab, to Israeli decision-making? I mean, do you have a sense of how the risk calculus, the decision on how to respond, is playing out in the Israeli war cabinet, this smaller body that's making decisions about the war, and more broadly within Netanyahu's governing coalition?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's hard to know exactly what the views are, but there are leaks to the media all the time. And there was one leak that actually Benny Gantz, who is the political rival to Netanyahu and who joined the war cabinet after October 7th and are considered kind of the more moderates in the cabinet. There was a leak the other day that he actually was advocating for immediately responding hard in Iran. So it's hard to understand if there is really a restraining actor in the cabinet. In general, Netanyahu has worked with hawkish national security advisors in the past, and they have been coming out saying very clearly that Israel needs to respond forcefully. The regular cabinet includes the far-right settler ministers, Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. They've come out with these hyperbolic statements about making the earth shake in Iran and stuff like this. They're not the ones who are in the war cabinet right now that technically doesn't have the legal jurisdiction to make these decisions, but has been kind of certified to do so because of the circumstances. At the same time, you also have a military establishment and an IDF chief of staff. They're carrying this burden of the failure of October 7th. And the same people who are making the decisions now just miscalculated the Damascus strike on the consular facility. And they also don't seem to have a very good hold and understanding of their adversaries right now.
So it's certainly true that the Israeli leadership seems to have miscalculated the Damascus strikes, maybe didn't anticipate Iran's response. I mean, maybe this is clutching at straws, but maybe the scale of that response, of Iran's response, could lead to more caution. I mean, what about, Myra, what about Israelis more broadly? I mean, I know some polling suggests that a majority don't support an escalation with Iran. I guess still the trauma of the 7th of October, hostages still in Gaza, now this major Iranian attack, which, although it was thwarted, must have been very alarming. What's the chance that impetus for restraint comes from Israeli society?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's only been a few days, so it's hard to tell. But, it's the 6-month mark of the Gaza war a couple of weeks ago. There were a lot of articles that came out and a lot of feelings of frustration that Israel is just not achieving its war goals. And it's hard to overstate just how unstable and insecure Israelis feel. I mean, on Saturday night, people slept in shelters because they didn't know what was going to happen. And so I don't think the public is at all interested or ready in any kind of new front. And the former head of the Shin Bet, former prime ministers, they're all coming out now and saying Netanyahu is unfit to lead. And so the notion that these people who have been making all these mistakes would now decide on possibly going to war with Iran on new rules of the game in this very sensitive and precarious situation is making a lot of Israelis very nervous.
Though if Netanyahu faces this pressure at home that you describe, Myra, in some ways, Iran's attacks have changed the narrative to some degree in Western capitals, drawn attention away from the sort of frustration, anger expressed about Israel's military operations in Gaza and the lack of humanitarian aid getting in, and sort of shifted focus to this sort of danger from Iran and the danger of a regional escalation.
Yeah, well, it's hard to ignore the fact that just days ago we were focused on an imminent famine in Gaza. The world watched as the World Central Kitchen's convoy was struck by Israel. And so, you know, Netanyahu, they were talking about conditioning aid to Israel in the U.S. Nancy Pelosi was talking about conditioning aid to Israel, something that you would never think you would hear a few months ago. And then all of a sudden, everything has switched now to the Iran-Israel axis. I don't think that was by design, but that's the result. And now Netanyahu, who has built his career on the Iran threat, now has the world seeing that Iran has these capabilities and that he needs the world to kind of, you know, come together to fight this enemy that he's been talking about for 20 years.
And Ali, just before we come to Michael in the US, you talked about the regime in Tehran feeling pressure from its core supporters to respond more forcefully to the Damascus strike. But what's the sense, you know, in Iranian society more broadly about this sort of latest escalation?
Right. So there are three broad categories of reactions within the Iranian population. One is the regime's core constituents, and they're very happy with this attack. And the way that this thing has grabbed international attention for many days now is further confirmation from their perspective of Iran's power and standing in the region. And so I think the core constituents of the Islamic Republic are very satisfied. At the other end of the spectrum, you have the hardcore regime opponents inside the country who basically see the regime's foe as their friend. And they have been expressing sympathy for Israel from October 7th. You see graffiti being painted on the walls, expressing support for Israel, asking Israel to retaliate against Iran. And then you have, I would say, the majority of the Iranian people in the middle, who are sick and tired of living in a constant state of crisis, who are paying the economic price of this confrontation. Iranian rial has lost a lot of its value just over the course of the past 2 weeks. Inflation has skyrocketed, and people are concerned. This is a nation that went through a traumatic 8-year war against Iraq about 30 years ago and doesn't want a repeat of the same experience. And you see also Iranian human rights activists coming out and basically pushing back against the prospect of a military confrontation, which they know would only strengthen the most hardline elements within the Islamic Republic and would allow them to further militarize the internal sphere and further push back the cause of democracy in Iran.
And Ali, how much of what you describe in terms of opposition to the government, even expressions, as you say, of support for Israel, how much of that is new? And would, for example, a direct strike on Iran by Israel change things?
A lot of it is new because the fissure between the state and the society has been significantly deepened over the past few years. But I don't think we should underestimate Iranian sense of nationalism, the strong sense of national identity. And so if indeed we end up in a state of open conflict between Iran and the U.S. or Iran and Israel or both, I think we would see a rally around the flag effect. Now, would it be as strong as when Saddam invaded Iran in 1980? I doubt it. But it would still, I think, benefit the regime overall and add to its shelf life.
So let's come then to the U.S. and Washington, other Western capitals, clearly trying to persuade Israel since Iran's attack, either not to respond or to respond with restraint. So we had the UK Foreign Secretary, the German Foreign Minister in Tel Aviv this week. US President Joe Biden himself, I think, said something like, you know, Israel should take the win. There wasn't a lot of damage. Now is not the time to take things up a notch.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an accurate characterization. Merav mentioned quite a bit of Israeli popular nervousness. And frankly, there's a lot of nervousness here in the United States within the administration. I think it's a reflection of the lack of trust between this administration and the current Israeli government, and a concern about their decision making. From the start of the war, there were sort of twin aims on the part of the United States. A first set of aims with respect to support of Israel and its war in Gaza. The second set of U.S. goals related to the region and the effort to limit regional escalation. That fear of an all-out regional war has shaped the U.S. approach from the get-go. I would say it's been partially successful. We have seen incremental regional escalation, whether that's between Israel and Hezbollah, whether it's among Iran-backed militia actors in Syria and Iraq. And the Houthis have escalated, and we've seen the Red Sea become a zone of conflict and disrupt global shipping. So, you know, U.S. efforts have managed to avoid the all-out regional fight, but they haven't been fully successful. And for the United States, it's not just a question of regional stability. From the start, there has been an assumption that if various thresholds were crossed, this conflict would draw the United States in directly. And that's an outcome that the United States wants to avoid at all costs. And so I think the message from the United States has been quite clear. There has been an effort to provide Israel with a successful narrative about the air defense operation that was undertaken not just with the United States, but with the cooperation and coordination with other U.S. regional partners. And it seems from the tenor of this discussion that the initial American hope that perhaps Israel would forego an immediate response, that maybe is misplaced. It is difficult to establish a new equilibrium, to create new rules of engagement. And again, the capacity for misperception and miscalculation remains quite high.
And Michael, so the US officials say that they didn't know about Israel's attack on the Damascus consulate building beforehand, or at least they only found out at the last minute. Yet, of course, as you'd expect, when Iran responded, US, other Western allies, very involved in protecting Israel. I mean, for all that the US might be urging restraint, presumably, if things really escalate between Iran and Israel, it's very hard to see the US not getting sucked in.
No, I think that's right. Others have pointed out that there's real moral hazard here, and that the fact that there is this implicit US backstop in terms of wider war, that this might encourage risk-taking. And that's always been a concern for the U.S. because I think you're right. If we're looking at something that looks much more like an all-out regional war with direct hostilities between Iran and Israel, in which case we also then have to think about what Hezbollah does in Lebanon, then yes, it's hard to imagine that the United States sits on the sidelines and watches that unfold. And of course, the United States is not sitting on the sidelines, right? We've seen an expansion of what the United States is doing militarily to include US-UK coordinated airstrikes in Yemen, stepped up retaliatory strikes in Syria and Iraq that have become a real problem for US-Iraq relations. And the question in the case of a further escalatory cycle between Iran and Israel, I don't think is whether the United States would get involved, because that's a foregone conclusion. And that's a troubling dynamic, particularly for the United States at the moment, and an administration that really wants to avoid that kind of outcome.
Yeah, look, I think Michael is absolutely right about the risks here, but it's important to take into account that Iran and the United States actually share objectives. They don't want any further escalation or expansion of the conflict in Gaza. And I wouldn't be surprised if we learn that there has been a degree of contact, whether direct or indirect, since April 1st attack on Iranian consulate, to try to contain these tensions as much as possible. But the problem is, at the end of the day, the U.S. doesn't have full control on any of these actors, and there is plenty of risk for miscalculation on all sides, as we've already discussed.
And what about the politics in Washington? I mean, how important are the voices, some Republicans in particular, that are calling for the U.S. to back or even push for a stronger response from Israel?
Well, I mean, there is always a constituency for those who would like to see a war with Iran. That's not new. And so we've seen, I think, predictably, some calls for stepped up U.S. involvement and direct targeting of Iran. It's mostly along partisan lines, and even there, it is not uniform. It's not extraordinary new pressure. The Biden administration seems quite comfortable in holding this line on restraint. Partisan politics, of course, are going to be part of any national security discussion, and Iran is one of the most politicized of these topics. But I don't see that largely partisan pressure really influencing how the administration thinks about its own response.
And what about other pressure on Tehran? So some talk of the administration imposing more sanctions, tightening up its enforcement of the existing sanctions.
So because there are no attractive policy options for the Biden administration right now, as usual, they're opting for the path of least resistance, which is additional sanctions. But the reality is, Richard, as we have discussed on this podcast before, the U.S. has already maxed out its sanctions leverage against Iran. So there might be some measures of imposing sanctions on Iran's ballistic missile and drone program, but they are already sanctioned to the hilt. The one thing that the U.S. can do is enforcement of existing sanctions, which would target Iranian oil exports to China. But there's a limit to how far the U.S. can go without China's cooperation. And I don't think China is going to be on board with such policy. Of course, in the middle of all of this, if Iran starts enriching to 90% or ratcheting up its nuclear activities, it would just add an additional layer of problems. And Iran has demonstrated restraint in how far it's willing to go to provide ballistic missiles for Russia's war of aggression in Ukraine. And that, too, could become an additional problem that I think policymakers should take into account.
And how might an Israeli attack on Iran or an escalation with Israel impact those nuclear calculations, Ali, that you just mentioned?
The reality is that Iranians see their nuclear program in two different ways. One is leverage at the negotiating table to get out from under U.S. sanctions. But also there is the option of using their nuclear program as a way station towards nuclear weapons, as the ultimate deterrent. And here's where these two issues, I think, connect. One is that increasingly it appears that Iran's conventional capabilities and Iran's regional deterrence are not sufficient to protect the Iranian territory from the U.S. or Israel. And second, I think the Iranians increasingly don't see a way to use their nuclear leverage at the negotiating table to get out from under U.S. sanctions. And those two things together, I think, could move them towards considering crossing the Rubicon and developing a nuclear weapon.
And could we talk, Michael, for a moment about the war in Gaza? And as Myra mentioned earlier, the danger of regional escalation has sort of shifted attention in the US to some degree away from what's happening in Gaza toward efforts to avert a wider war. Now, obviously, it depends a bit on what happens next. But what do you think that means for at least American efforts to get more aid into Gaza, to push for a ceasefire?
Obviously, the threat of all-out regional war and this latest escalatory cycle with Iran has overshadowed the war in Gaza and probably changed the atmospherics, particularly around U.S.-Israel relations. Merav, you know, mentioned the kinds of discussions that were happening prior to the Iranian strikes, focused on the sort of looming and perhaps beginning of famine in parts of Gaza, the strike on humanitarian aid workers, the discussion of conditionality of U.S. assistance in many quarters. All of that's quite new, that has taken a back seat as Israel has come under attack. Now, I think the administration wants to use its defense of Israel and its leveraging of its own partnerships in the region as a further selling point for diplomacy, that Israel shouldn't try to jeopardize that goodwill.
Michael, could I just ask on that? You mentioned the U.S. leveraging its own partnerships in the region and that Arab countries, Jordan involved, reportedly even Saudi perhaps involved in stopping Iranian missiles, drones getting through. But that's best seen as a reflection of their determination to stop a regional war, no? And of their relations with the U.S. It doesn't necessarily signal a change in their policies toward Israel, especially not sort of given public anger about what's happening in Gaza, especially not without a ceasefire in Gaza.
Yeah. There are real political constraints about how those relationships can evolve. And we see this very clearly, say, with Jordan's participation in this operation, which, of course, is hugely controversial domestically. And so if you're the Jordanians thinking about your approach to U.S.-led security efforts and Israel in the future, how Israel responds now on things that matter to you are going to be quite consequential. And of course, the Jordanians have, like many others in the region, focused on the necessity of de-escalation and the need for a ceasefire in Gaza. But the ceasefire talks themselves seem to have not gained further traction.
So maybe then just to end this segment and come back to the danger of a regional war. Again, we're recording this on Wednesday, so this could get overtaken. But it's right to think that U.S. officials are genuinely worried about the direction this could go.
I think it would be a mistake to assume that the U.S. feels comfortable in terms of knowing what Israel is getting ready to do. And obviously, there's been a lot of effort to communicate concerns about targets that might be out of bounds. And there is also the real unknown, which is Iranian response. I think the U.S. and others have managed the crisis fairly well in terms of, as Ali mentioned, creating these lines of communication in the hopes of minimizing and mitigating the risks for miscalculation. But looking at the mistakes, I would say, and the miscalculations that went into getting the region to this point, it would be foolhardy to have a lot of confidence that the region had sort of made it through this crisis unscathed.
Ali, Michael, Mairav, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
So we're going to turn now to what's happening in Gaza. Just under a couple of weeks ago, Crisis Group put out a report on the humanitarian situation in the Strip, the risk of famine. And I spoke on Thursday this week, so April the 18th, to the two main authors of that report, Lahib Higel and Rob Bletcher. And I started by asking Lahib about whether, since we published that report, more aid is now getting into the Strip.
More aid trucks are making it in through the Kerem Shalom border crossing in the south, but it's not sufficient. There's also a remaining problem of what is actually on those trucks. For a very long time, the Israelis have imposed quite stringent restrictions on so-called dual-use items. And that includes a range of goods, even food cans, because the motivation is that the tin can be used for IEDs, for instance, or certain components of medical equipment or tent poles. But there are some 300 trucks that are making it in on a daily basis. That is a good increase, but the pre-war level was 500. And that included a functioning commercial sector inside Gaza, which has completely broken down. The second improvement, if it gets going, is that the Israelis have agreed to facilitate aid through the Ashdod port and to open up the Erez border crossing, which makes access into northern Gaza a direct entry. And lastly, one of the main issues, I think, for aid distribution over the past 6 months has been the lack of deconfliction between the humanitarian sector and the IDF. So up until very recently, the notification of humanitarians for their locations or for their movements have gone to a civilian authority, COGAT, that hasn't necessarily passed on that information to commanders in the field. Now, what has been promised is that humanitarians will have a direct line to deconflict their movements with the IDF on the ground through the Southern Command.
And presumably that's something that's been put in place after the killing of the World Central Kitchen workers.
Indeed. Unfortunately, it took the killing of international staff for this to happen. There has been already staff of UNRWA, of MSF and other organizations that have been killed.
And so that's at the aid actually getting in. And you talked about the deconfliction, which relates to the distribution. But what about the protection and the problems of law and order that were also obstructing the delivery of aid once it actually got in?
Yeah, that's continued to be a problem. Although in the last couple weeks, I think things have gotten a little bit easier. It was the civilian police that were responsible for protecting the aid. In February, Israel began to target the civilian police. The next month, when Hamas formed emergency committees, once those were formed, Israel started targeting those as well as the senior police officers, some of whom had ties to the Gaza government's internal intelligence service. That then broke down the aid distribution. What we understand is that in the past couple weeks, Israel has stopped trying to work with its own preferred families in the north, just because it was getting almost blanket refusal to cooperate. And so now it seems like it's mainly the civil police in civilian clothes, along with some of the families informally. That's the best kind of cooperation that we can imagine right now.
And Rob, previously the Israelis saw the civilian police as part of the Hamas-led government of Gaza. Is that not the case anymore?
An Israeli spokesperson once, when asked this question about civil police, he said something like, Hamas is Hamas, or, you know, Hamas police are still Hamas. I think it's a mistake to conflate the entirety of the civil police with Hamas as a movement. The civil police is the least politicized of Gaza's security forces, which doesn't mean that it's not politicized, but it's the least politicized. There are members of all different factions that are part of the police. Where it gets complicated is that some of the most senior police commanders also have ties to the Internal Security Agency, which is a government agency responsible for domestic security, just like the FBI in the U.S. or the Shin Bet in Israel. And so they do have a certain regime protection function. And it's understandable why Israel would be targeting those people in the midst of a war. But not everybody engaged with aid delivery is connected in that way. We need to at least protect some people who have the capacity to protect the aid, and that would be the civil police.
So Prime Minister Netanyahu is still threatening an operation in Rafah, in this city in the south where many people in Gaza have been displaced to. But in reality, the tempo of military operations in Gaza, it's not the same as a few weeks ago, right? And that predates Israel's strike on Iran's Damascus consulate.
The active ground operations have been not only in a holding pattern, but many of the forces have withdrawn from Gaza. Israel finished the Khan Yunis operation, and it pulled all of its maneuvering troops out. The only forces that were left at that point were the forces in a relatively small strip, which is now known as the Netzarim Corridor, which divides Gaza into northern and southern sectors just south of Gaza City. There were some operations in the center. In the last day or two, there have been more operations in the north in areas that Israel had already theoretically cleared. So military operations are in a pause, but that does not mean that the pressure on the population is in a pause. There's still a lot of pressure on the Gazan population, as Lahib was just saying.
And as Lahib said, so more aid, but not enough, is getting in. Some of the distribution channels in Gaza have improved. But do we have a sense of whether people are actually starving? I mean, has the UN said that famine has set in yet?
Well, declaration of a famine is a political declaration, a political decision. What we have is, on March 18th, the IPC, the Integrated Phase Classification System, sort of the gold standard of a famine assessment, made the assessment that famine is imminent in the north of Gaza, and projected that on the trajectory that was current at the time, that, you know, by July, some 70% of the north would be in famine. There are no more statistics that have come out since the IPC made that evaluation. However, some, including UN agencies, have made the logical extrapolations from what the situation was a month ago now to say that, well, because there's no monitoring system and we were pretty close to the threshold already a month ago, that we would have transcended the last little bit between what the situation was a month ago and what it is now. So, you know, whether you consider it to have started or not is, you know, is a matter of definition at this point.
Maybe one point to what Rob said. I mean, as long as we remain in the situation where not enough aid is making it in, it will be very difficult to mitigate the famine. You would need a broad range of interventions. It's not only food. You also need health, hygiene, sanitation to function, because many of the deaths are disease-related. And so we don't have that level of improvement in terms of aid and professionals that are making it into the strip to address the various sectors that need to respond.
And so, maybe to end, where do the talks about a ceasefire, the release of the Israeli hostages, I mean, those talks for now are seemingly ground to a halt, or at least are on hold?
By all indications, the negotiations are going poorly, although sometimes it's difficult to know whether the reports of slow progress are really about the negotiations themselves or whether they're about pressure techniques.
But there's no talks actually taking place now, right?
Yeah, although the Americans have said that they think that the players can come back again. But you're right that they're not actively negotiating now.
And if they do end up restarting, still the core challenge seems to be that Hamas wants a permanent ceasefire, but Israel looking for something shorter term as a way to get some of the hostages back, but not wanting to commit to a longer term end to the war.
That is still the core challenge. There are a couple big issues, with one being bigger than the other. So the biggest of the issues is, as you said, that Hamas wants the war to end, and Israel is looking for a pause in the war to get some of the hostages back, finish off this period of recuperation for their troops before continuing the fight in Rafah. For Hamas wants the war to end, free return of Gazans to their homes or to the area where their homes were formerly located in the north. Israel wants to restrict that movement. Hamas also wants Israel to withdraw completely from the Strip as opposed to just from some limited areas. And it also wants to start figuring out the reconstruction mechanism. From Israel's perspective, those are four very big demands. From Hamas's perspective, those are four very logical things for them to expect during a ceasefire.
And yet, there's been a lot of intransigence from both sides, of course, but from what I understand, from the perspective of US officials, from Washington's perspective, they sort of feel that the ball is in Hamas's court. Is that fair? Why do they think that?
Well, the US has made what it considers to be a very generous offer to Hamas. And part of the reason why the U.S. thinks that it is a generous offer is that the Israelis don't like elements of it. The U.S. put on the table that 150,000 Gazans would be able to return to the north. For Israel, that's a big number. But if you think about it, that's only a small fraction of the number that were displaced originally from the north. The way that they tried to bridge the gap between a temporary pause and an end to the war was that one of the ways they tried to bridge it was that at the beginning of the ceasefire, it would be announced as a temporary ceasefire. But Qatar and Egypt, behind the scenes, told Hamas that they would guarantee that the temporary would become open-ended before the fighting resumed. Hamas did not accept those guarantees. They weren't sure Qatar or Egypt could deliver that. And so they wanted to hear it directly from Israel, and Israel has not been willing to say that.
And Rob, tell me if this is wrong. I mean, we've talked about it a bit on the show before, but it seems at least plausible, you know, if not likely, that there may not actually be a formal ceasefire. Instead, there'll be periods of more intense fighting, continued operations against the remnants of Hamas, Gaza, in some ways, in a much longer limbo.
Yeah, it's very possible that there might not be a day after, that the what people have talked about a day after as a definitive end to the Israeli operation and moving into the next stage. Right from the beginning, Israel said that there would be a number of phases to the war. There was the initial bombing, then there was the ground operation, and now they're coming to the end of the ground operations, and there will be continuing, as Israel would say, pinpoint or counterterrorism or counterinsurgency operations that are already happening in the north and will continue to happen around the Strip. So if you look at it that way, the war is proceeding more or less as Israel planned, not in the sense that they've made as much progress as quickly as they thought that they would, because it has been slow going, because Hamas has proven difficult and the tunnels especially have proven a formidable obstacle. But Israel expected this to be a years-long operation, and at this point we're a little over 6 months into that. And Israel is about to complete this second stage and move into a third stage.
Rob Lahib, thanks for coming on.
Quite welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hold Your Fire is a production of the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. You can find all of Crisis Group's work on the recent escalation. We put out a couple of statements this past week on our website, crisisgroup.org. Thanks to our producers, Kevin Murphy, Heiko Schaub, and thanks as ever to all of you, our listeners. If you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, please do get in touch. podcast@crisisgroup.org or atwood@crisisgroup.org. If you like the show, please do say something nice about us, leave us a good rating wherever you get your podcasts, and I very much hope that you'll join us again next week.